Hello?
That's Zola Nene. My name is Sean Lewitz, and you're listening to Something Shifted, episode 29. Something Shifted is about leaning into change. It's that space between your head and your heart. It's estimated that the average adult makes about 35,000 remotely conscious decisions every single day. But what if you make a solid decision based on facts, weighing up the pros and cons, and then you decide to walk away from it all? Chef, food stylist, food writer, media personality, a recipe developer, video food creator, and of course, cooking show host, restaurant reviewer, and award-winning cookbook author. But it wasn't always so easy for Zola Nene. So what do you reckon is the biggest mental hurdle you've had to overcome to find the joy that you have today?
I think definitely imposter syndrome.
Mm.
That's a real thing. I don't know if I've overcome it. I think that I'm just a bit kinder to myself. Because I realize that like the trajectory of my career is mad. Like, especially at the time at which it happened, like everything happened for a reason. I quit law, went to the UK, went into chef school, planned to go to Joburg, and then Espresso as an opportunity came along, like just at the right time when I was thinking about coming back. Do you know what I mean? Like all these things happened so that it, you know, I was in the right place and able to, you know, become who I was. Often I think to myself, am I deserving? Do you know what I mean? There's lots of talented people out there. There's lots of people who also have opportunities, but they don't necessarily go the way that mine have. Grateful, absolutely, that it has put me where I am. But sometimes I'm just like, am I deserving? And like I say, I've become kinder to myself. And I do say to my, in those moments, I say, but I've actually worked really hard to get here. So it's not all just been handed to me. I've taken opportunities and made the best of them or put my spin on certain things and also said no at the right time and yes at the right time and made difficult moves at the right time. So I'm able to process it that way and be like, I am deserving because I worked hard and I continue to work hard and I continue to try and grow and I continue to try and learn. So yeah, but it still creeps in.
So there you have it. Zola, in her own words, quit law 2 years into her degree, a decision that most certainly could not have been easy to make. Since the age of around 15, she knew that's what she wanted to do with her life.
Yeah, there was no question that I was going to leave school and go and study law. My family actually moved to Norway the year that I finished matric. So my parents even gave me the option. They're like, do you still want to go to university and study law, or do you want to come with us to Norway and maybe study there? And I was like, no, I'm set. I know what I'm going to do.
But then something shifts. And she realizes it really isn't the space for her.
And 2 years in, I was like,
While many people frame quitting as failure because you've set your mind on doing something, but you've fallen short of that, I prefer looking at quitting as realizing that you're spending energy on something that just isn't serving you. So in Zola's case, she's clearly surrounded by somebody, some things that have given her the courage to realize that she's going down the wrong path. Who or what are some of the inspirations that have shaped you?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think what shaped me, probably what molded me the most, or actually what molded my mindset, I want to say, is definitely my parents and their work ethic. My dad in particular, he worked really hard all of his life. He comes from very, very humble beginnings. And he made choices that put him in, you know, right places so they could provide for himself, therefore provide for his family, and was always had like an open dialogue about what you should want your life to look like based on your feelings, not based on, which is why when I said, oh, I'm gonna quit law, and he was like, okay, cool, do that. What makes you happy, type of thing. So seeing somebody who genuinely loved what they did, I understood what that meant. And I grew up knowing that that was possible. So I guess in a way, he made it possible for me to go, I'm not really happy doing this. Let me change paths and see something else. So I think that molded my mind in a very substantial way. And also like not wanting to disappoint the people who really, you know, sacrificed for me. I mean, yeah, my parents did a lot for me to be able to go to chef school and go to the UK and learn how to cook and do all these things. So I think that they were very influential in who I am and, yeah, being able to choose a path that wasn't so what's the word? Not the norm. Because, chefs and people on TV and food personalities wasn't a thing. I told you, I'm old. So it wasn't a thing that it wasn't visible like it is now. There was nobody who looked like me on TV for me to go, this is who I want to sort of emulate or become and do what they do. So, yeah.
Do you remember what it was that sparked that shift for you?
Yes. What I found really interesting was criminal law and family law.
Okay.
And for me, those are like so extreme. I knew I could never survive a courtroom defending whatever it is. I would cry, and nobody wants a crying lawyer. Nobody wants a crying lawyer. Do you know what I mean? Like, I knew I just couldn't do that. And the rest was a hell of a ball.
Was chefing the very next thing that you thought of?
Absolutely. Because I loved food so much.
Okay.
So when I wasn't doing the law books and stuff, I was reading food magazines, cookbooks. I was watching food shows. There was like four at the time, but, you know, I was watching them all the time. I knew that was like something of major interest for me. And even in university, I used to love to cook for the people who stayed in my sort of private res.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, guys, I'm going to cook us all pasta. And they were all very complimentary. And I really enjoyed doing it.
It was around this time that Zola met someone in her very complex that was studying at chef school.
Oh, that's interesting. And I sort of got talking to them and they were telling me about, you know, what they were doing, what they were learning. And I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. And yeah. And when my dad asked me, okay, so you don't like law? You don't enjoy law? What do you like to do without even thinking about it? And I said, I like to cook. That was literally the response. And that's where it all started.
If we go back to what you were saying earlier about imposter syndrome, I mean, it's a behavioral health phenomenon. I kind of like phenomenon more than syndrome. And they describe it as sort of self-doubt of your own intellect, right? When you're starting to feel less confident in your abilities, regardless of what you've achieved. And I guess it happens to all of us as we start to step into slightly bigger realms, right? You go from school to studying something, you gain knowledge, you develop those skills, and then you step into a working world, and then you step into a different career path entirely.
Exactly. I think it's good to do I mean, there's lots of, I mean, I was just a chef on Espresso and not having intended to be somebody on television anyway. I was, you know, behind the scenes, and then I got thrown into front of the camera and loved it and thrived, thank goodness. And then I got offered to judge the Great South African Bake Off season 3, I think it was, that I judged. And I remember in that moment going, hang on, is it me that they want?
Yeah.
Like, how is it me that they want? And I was like, okay, well, I guess they believe in me. Let me try, and loved it. And then, you know, the next thing that came along was, I guess, Tastemaster and MasterChef. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like each one is like an elevation of the same type of thing. And it's scary, but it's so wonderful. It's so rewarding to be part of people's like beginning of their careers.
Since you mentioned the beginning of a career, can you give me an idea of how you feel your first job prepared you for being on set with Gordon Ramsay?
Well, I mean, my first job was literally as a commis chef in the UK, peeling potatoes, peeling carrots, peeling onions, chopping onions, frying onions, making mash, making potato things. That was literally my first job. So I could take orders. Maybe that's what prepared me for Gordon. But yeah, my very first job was sort of when I'd stopped doing law and I was starting to explore the culinary arts thing. And my dad said, go to the UK, because it was either France or UK who took culinary art or chefing as a profession seriously at the time. Like, you could actually study to be a chef and be respected there. Obviously France was out of the question. I couldn't speak French, so obviously England it was. And I had no experience at all, so they threw me into the lowest rung of the ladder in terms of positions, and I loved it. What, rumbling potatoes and carrots in a rumble machine? I didn't even know a rumbler existed.
Okay, so you reckon that job prepared you for taking orders from Gordon Ramsay?
Yeah. I also think, I mean, I say that jokingly, but I think that paying your dues in a kitchen is a very important thing. It's like, it's very important to take those steps in order to sort of gain respect in a lot of ways. So having done all of that and being able to sort of sit now as a chef who isn't in a traditional kitchen, but I know how a traditional kitchen runs. I've been in a traditional kitchen. I know what it feels like to have pans thrown at you. I know what the anxiety and thrill and high energy situation that service can be, all of that stuff. I know what it's like, so I can relate to traditional chefs as well. I think that that also puts me in a really great position. Yeah. So I'm not just a face on TV. I'm actually a chef. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I think that also means you get the respect from other chefs because you have the skills.
I like to think so. But, you know, like as with in every situation, respect is earned. So no, I wouldn't expect them to respect me just based on the fact that I've said I've worked in kitchens. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, also fine. Also fine.
But just so that we are clear, when you were on set with Gordon Ramsay, you weren't necessarily taking orders from him, were you?
No. It was a very different scenario because he was obviously coming to South Africa to learn about our food. So he didn't have the upper hand, if you will. So he wasn't like,
he was your guest. Yeah,
exactly. He wasn't F-bomb Gordon. He was lovely. Truly, truly and really. I was ready to go toe to toe.
I'm sure.
I was ready. I was like, you throw an F-bomb, I'm throwing two. But he was just such a delight. He really wanted to learn. That's the thing. I think that's the beauty of that show, Uncharted, is that he is, you know, put in such uncomfortable places. And usually he's the one who enters people's spaces and makes them uncomfortable because he's coming there to help them. Whereas this was pure learning for him. So he wanted to come in, learn about the culture, learn about the food, and then recreate something together to serve to somebody. So he was very receptive, very respectful, just all around lovely. And that was a week. You know, if you spend a week with somebody, you eventually see if they're, you know, pretending to be nice or not. And he was truly so lovely.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And he sent me a copy of his book lately, and like, and he'll like, we follow each other on Instagram. You know what I mean? Like he really immersed himself in the experience, but also genuinely connected with me chef to chef. Do you know what I mean? Like when he sees something cool that I've done, he goes, oh, that's cool, darling, or whatever it is. Yeah, he's a nice guy. Yeah. Really.
If I remember correctly, the brief story behind that, and there's quite a long story behind that show, but on the show itself, you were sharing your culture with him.
Yes, in KZN. When they originally contacted me, they said they're thinking about coming to South Africa and they're trying to pinpoint where to go. And I said, I am a Zulu girl, very proud Zulu girl. And I don't think KZN as a food region is highlighted enough. And there's so much eclectic stuff happening there. And, you know, the Indian culture is amazing there, and of course the Zulu culture. So I was like, just throwing out there, you know, I know everyone loves to come to Cape Town or everyone loves to go to Joburg, and both fantastic, but I think that a personal story for me would definitely be to go to KZN. They were all like, oh, KZN, okay, cool, bye. And and then they came back to me like 3 months later, because I thought, oh, well, I blew that. They didn't like that idea. Like 3 months later, they were like, okay, cool, sounds awesome. We'll go to KZN. Oh, and by the way, can you definitely be on the show? Because originally, it was just, we were just throwing out ideas. It wasn't that I was going to be on the show.
So you were more like
a consultant.
Yeah, like a location scout of sorts.
Yeah, like a recce agent, I guess. Everybody saw the conversation we had and they were like, oh, well, let's have her be part of the show. I was like, oh, well, that's cool. And that's literally how it happens. So back then, they hadn't told me what the show is. They're like, it's all embargoed. We can't. Because they can't even call him by name.
Yeah.
Because as soon as people hear Gordon, frenzy.
Yeah, frenzy.
I think, what do they call them? They call him, I want to say El Chapo, but that's not it. That's not it. The team came down, I think, about 6 months before. We went to KZN. We spent a few days there. We sort of talked about the markets and all the type of things, scenarios that we could, you know, have. And then, they sort of finalized stuff. And then they came back maybe 4 months later and we shot it and we cooked for a chief, a Zulu chief, like a very prominent Zulu chief. So that was really cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah.
Great memories.
Well, great memory. Gosh, can't believe that was my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that.
Yeah, you did.
I cooked with Gordon Ramsay in front of a hippo. And that hippo thing was serious, hey? We almost died.
Hippos are not to be taken lightly.
Dramatic. We didn't almost die. There was a hippo. that was in the lake where we had been positioned to cook at. So in the morning we arrived, they're like, okay, we didn't know this male hippo was going to be here. And they said, okay, for health and safety, there's a ranger with a gun that's standing by 10 meters away from you guys, because obviously that's the closest they could be for the filming scenario.
Yeah.
And they said, we're parking a bucky with the bottom thing down, running the entire time. If the marshal gives you a signal, it means this thing is charging. This thing will come, it will get you in 10 seconds flat. So when I give you the signal, you run. I said, run? Me? I said, me? I said, run me. So clearly I'm getting eaten by the hippo if anything happens. But they said, you run, you jump on this thing, and we're driving off. Like, there's no
thinking. Just do it. Yeah.
So the whole time. So Gordon knows he's running faster than me. So he's chilled. He's like, if anyone's going to get eaten here, it's me. So he was teasing the whole time. He's like, oh, it's coming, it's coming. Like, every time we film something, he's like, oh, and I'm like, ah, start running. He's like, where are you going? There's nothing. So the danger was imminent.
Wow.
But it was fun nonetheless. Nothing happened. So we can talk about it in happy spirits.
You're here to tell the tale.
Yeah.
When you step away from something, it's a game of chance. You never really know how it's going to work out. But it seems quite evident that Zola has gained a lot of colorful life experiences by exchanging the courtroom for the kitchen. Any other culinary stories like that happen off camera that never quite make it onto show? Celeb Feasts was a big show that you did as well.
Oh.
All of the judging stuff that you've done with the various cooking shows.
Celeb Feasts, we had a lot of dramatic moments. We had one guest who was drunker than anyone I've ever seen before. That was a hard one. I thought, once we'd finished filming, I thought to myself, if they can put together an edit that actually works, these people are at the top of their game. And they put together an edit, and it worked.
Wow.
And no one was the wiser. People watching, no idea.
Didn't know.
Sloshed.
But that puts so much pressure on you, camera, that has to pretend. And because eyeballs give things away.
Totally. And you've got to, like, you know, when you're the drunk one, everything's funny.
Yes.
And it's just like, I'm the host, so I can't shut you down because you think everything's funny. So I've got to laugh at some of the stuff, but then I've got to also bring it all back to, like, okay, cooking. Tell me about your life. Like, yeah, it was a lot. Yeah, that was a tough one.
Of late, I've started making decisions that my future self will thank me for.
Oh.
So I like to, if somebody says to me, are you available to do X? And I'll think about it. And if it's immediately yes, then obviously it's an immediate yes. But if I can tell that maybe in a couple of months' time or in a couple of weeks' time when this thing actually has to happen, it doesn't quite spark, the joy.
You have that foresight?
And I'll be like, actually, my future self...
No.
Is not going to appreciate me putting them through that hell. So I'm going to say no now.
Wait, mind blown. How do you... hang on. Okay, teach me your ways. So scenario, I invite you for lunch in 2 weeks' time.
Yep.
So I'm also going to invite so-and-so. It's chilled, whatever. Your immediate thought is, I'd like to go for lunch, but I don't really want to do a crowd thing. So then do you kick in and go, because I know I'm not going to enjoy being in a crowd or in a group of people with people I don't know, I'd rather say no. And you don't say yes and then cancel later. You
Correct.
Say no then. That is such a power move. And I don't think I can do such things.
I find that it takes the pressure off the build up towards the event.
I know that anxiety.
Instead of me saying yes, already knowing that I have a thing the night before and I'm going to be tired and I have something due on the Monday and I need the time to, and I've already kind of gone that weekend, I'm supposed to block time out. Or, we're talking hypothetical situations here because you've invited me, I'm definitely coming. but hypothetically, that's exactly how I would go about it. I'd rather say to you no now so that neither of us have to get worked up when it gets to the day before. I feel so bad, I'm leaving it to the last minute.
Okay.
I'd rather say no up front.
Okay, and also the reason for the no makes sense. Because if you go, no, I can't this Sunday, and I'm like, okay, well, let's do it on the Thursday or whatever. But you actually just don't want to come for lunch with me.
Yeah, but that would never be the case.
No,
but hypothetically.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So do you then still go, actually, still no for my future self?
Especially if it's a scenario where I'm not necessarily in a space mentally where I want to take on a lot of other people and new people and meeting new people and having to put on the, this is me and this is my story and, you know, all of those things. If it's, again, scenario based, right? Mm. So if it's a bunch of people that I already know, super comfortable with, can rock up and they know it's going to be chilled, and you already have an idea of how you're going to slot in, makes it a lot easier.
Got you.
But it could be a work situation. The social is not always the same. Maybe it's a work situation and someone's offered you an opportunity.
Mm.
I'd love for you to do an interview for so-and-so about said thing. And I go, that sounds great.
Okay.
But I don't know if I'm going to be able to fit it in because I have to read somebody else's book and I have this other deadline of editing. But I want to do that thing.
That's,
so saving myself the anxiety, I'd rather say no now than have to drag myself through it all and then get to the situation hating
and
it. Which isn't easy.
Is it because I'm more of a yes person?
Maybe.
And it's something that I've definitely been working on being okay just saying no.
Mm.
Because sometimes you just don't want to hurt people's feelings.
100%. And I think this is a boundary thing. Mm. Especially for me, trying to set those boundaries, it's hard to maintain them. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm also not, I don't like saying no to people.
Yeah.
But if I think about it in a way that, you know, am I going to want to do this in a week's time when it's due?
Wow, I love that. I'm okay.
Try it. See
I'm
how it goes.
I'm definitely going to try it. I like that.
Well, now I have to know. Are there offers that have come your way that you've turned down and then afterwards gone, darn, I missed out on that?
No, because when I turn things down, it's genuinely because it doesn't resonate with me. So if it's a brand that I genuinely do not use or genuinely don't feel like it's right for me to endorse in any way, I pass it by and then it's an opportunity for someone else. And you know what I mean? When I see someone else do it, I feel, oh, good. That's a good match.
That's a good fit.
I mean?
Yeah.
That's a good fit. I'm glad that I passed it by so that somebody else could have the opportunity. So no, so I never, I've never passed anything by where I've thought, oh, I wish I'd done that.
But sometimes looked at it and go, oh, dodged a bullet there. That was a good decision.
There's lots of times when I go, yeah, I'll do it. And I'm like, oh, why the hell did I think this is a good
future thing? Self.
Future self.
Your future self.
Channel Sean.
I think we could sit here for hours and talk about all that you have gained by walking away from a dream that you'd had. Is there a particular achievement that you are most proud of?
For me, I think the cookbook awards for me, just because I've always said to you, Sean, that cookbooks are a forever project for me. And I do them truly because I want to leave a legacy behind. And I know that even long after I'm gone, the books and the recipes exist.
Mm.
And they're going to be passed down from family member to family member. There are kids, you know, generations away that haven't been born yet that are going to potentially cook my food. And that's my story being told long after I'm gone. So for me, books are like such a special project. And for people to, for anyone to recognize and say, oh, good job. Because that's what those awards are. I mean, they're nothing but somebody going, well done. You did a really good job putting down your food story and sharing it. So for me, those mean a lot to me.
I love the way you phrase that and the fact that the book will be handed down or shared amongst friends and family members. Guests come over and they often reach for my recipe books and they go, you've got this one. This recipe looks amazing. And that is very much the way people interact and socialize around food. And you're part of that story then.
Absolutely.
You just become drawn into their lives.
Yeah. And so my food story becomes part of their family food story because, you know, the lamb curry that I shared in one of my recipe books could become a family favorite of somebody else's. And they don't even have to know the origin story. But it's still, the thread is still there. And I think that that's what I love about them. I'm proud of my books.
And you should be.
Yeah.
Yeah, we look forward to another one.
Okay, Sean.
Please.
No pressure.
The next question.
Yes.
It's left by one of my previous guests. Mm-hmm. When's the last time you felt happy and you were aware of that happiness?
Wow. I think my most recent recollection was Christmas with my niece and nephew, or Christmas with the family, but my niece and nephew. Watching kids open gifts at Christmas is one of the best feelings ever. It's just, they actually don't even care what the gift is. It's the moment that's really happy. And with the, having the whole family around, because, you know, I'm aware that I'm getting older, therefore my parents are getting older, and you watch your parents getting older, and you know that those moments are few and far between. You know, eventually that scenario will never be able to happen again. So I'm very tuned in those moments. Just watching the joy, and if it's your gift that they're opening, you watch the person. So if they're opening your gift, for example, I watch you react to how they're reacting. And that's also like, oh, I think my niece and nephew just bring me so much happiness and joy in so many small moments as well. You're living things through the child of an or the eyes of a child is just like when they discover their fingers for the, it's like the, and you're just like, wow, they really just realize they have toes.
Yeah.
Like it's so amazing. I think that they are a true source of happiness for me, even in the smallest moments. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love
that. I watched your eyes well up when you were telling that story. Thank you, Zola.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Something Shifted. This is, in fact, the last episode of Season 2. But don't worry, we're going to take a short break just to work on Season 3, and we'll be back pretty soon. In the meantime, please consider leaving a positive review to help others find this show, or send it to someone that you know will enjoy this story right now. Plus, you'll find plenty more episodes of Something Shifted on your favorite player. Subscribe right now and never miss another story of hope and resilience. You can also find us online at somethingshifted.co.za and be one of the first to sign up for our monthly newsletter. If you use social media and you want to pop me a message, you can find me at Sean Lewitz. SEANLOOTS. I look forward to hearing from you. Until the next time, stay shifty, keep shifting, keep it shifted, shift away, shifts away, shift happens. Goodbye.